stocks starting the week with their worst decline in 8 months. But the big story in financial markets has been and continues to be the U.S. Treasury market, where yields continue to fall. And they were falling again Tuesday morning as we're recording this podcast. The 10-year note under 1.14% early in the morning. Joining us now to discuss all this and more is Blue Putnam, Chief Economist of the CME Group. Blue, welcome back to Alpha Trader.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be here.
It's great to have you because Stephen and I, for the last several weeks, we've been talking around this and about this idea of what is the message that the bond market is sending us when we're having all these big spikes in inflation readings and yet bond yields are falling. What is your big takeaway here for investors about what the message of the bond market is sending?
Well, the bond market's sending a couple of messages. The first one, I think, is pretty clear, that the bond market thinks that the inflation is temporary, or maybe I should say that a little differently. The bond market is buying into the Fed's guidance that the Fed is going to treat it as temporary. And so there's no need for higher yields at this point if you're taking on that view. The second thing, though, that's also important is that quite a few market participants were involved in what we call the reflation trade. But that was the idea that the economy was coming back super strong from the pandemic rebound, that higher inflation would last a little longer, and that bond yields really would have to rise. And, you know, that trade, the bond
market, it blew up on people, right?
That trade has been washed out. And yeah. When a trade like that gets washed out, it doesn't happen in a day. It takes a little time for everybody to decide how they want to reposition.
Interesting. So we've been talking a lot about whether the bond market is telling us that maybe the expectations about future economic growth have been overdone and overstated, and or that the revival of COVID concerns and the new variants that are out there are going to stall the recovery. As an economist, what is your view on that issue?
Well, the Delta variant is a very serious concern for, I think, everybody in the markets and in the economy and just living your life. And it has clearly become more of a focus in the last couple of weeks as different economies and around the world are trying different ways of dealing with it. And so I do think that we are in a period where our best rebound data is probably the data for June that we get in July. So, in the U.S., we got a really nice employment data. A lot of jobs were created. That's probably the best monthly jobs print we're going to see for the year. That doesn't mean we're going to go down. We're going to continue to add jobs, but not at the same pace. Later this week and next week, we'll get the real GDP numbers for the second quarter. And it's going to be a pretty good print. The Atlanta Fed guidance is that it's around 7.5% to 8% at an annual rate. It's a very good number. But that's probably also the best number for the rest of the year, just because the Delta variant is taking hold. And the rebound, you do the first 60-70% of your rebound relatively quickly, but the last 20-30% takes a lot longer. You know, it's that old 80-20 rule, not quite 80-20 in this case. That's what's going on here. The last bit's the hardest bit.
Let me pose a question. What if a lot of kind of the COVID infection fears that are making headlines now turn out to be just that fear, that we continue, that lockdowns do not return or travel keeps bumping along very nicely? Would that alter your outlook for economic growth, or would that alter your inflation outlook at all?
Well, it's definitely going to be something we're watching. We're probably, economists like myself, are going to probably go back into our toolkit of alternative data to see what happens, because by the time we get the official data on different things, it may be too late to understand it. So one of the pieces of data that I'm watching very closely is international air travel. Domestic air travel is pretty much back, but international air travel is not. And, this is a global phenomenon. The countries around the world are linked together. So we're going to see, what's going on with global air travel. But I think that that's been set back a little bit by the spread of the Delta virus. The other thing that we're watching, and kind of an alternative data, is we're going to be watching attendance at sporting events and compare it to 2019. You know, how's baseball how's baseball attending when the American football season gets started in September? How does that attendance look compared to 2019? You know, we really want to measure and get a handle on if people are saying we're back on full reopen, or are we, you know, being a little more careful with this Delta variant? And of course, we'll watch restaurant seatings and things like that to see where we are. So we're back in a framework of looking at alternative data to try to understand how the Delta variant is going to change behavior, because it clearly could.
And that's interesting. And, you know, you mentioned sporting events. This is a side note, but I have to think and hope that, you know, authorities in South America and in Europe are tracking attendees from the Copa America and the Euro Cup championships to see if those were spreader events, right? And you had, you know, large crowds at both tournaments. So hopefully we'll see that, yeah, if you're vaccinated, it's, you know, you're going to be okay. But before we get much deeper into this, I want to ask you, Blue, what is your baseline right now for second half economic growth and inflation?
Well, you know, there are different scenarios, but the kind of the baseline scenario is that real GDP in the U.S. And in many other countries is, you know, peaks in the second quarter. So it's behind us. And then we move down toward a more steady state growth path, the kind of the post-pandemic growth path. And that takes me into the world of demography and just understanding where we are. You know, we do know that the U.S. and many Europe, Japan, China are facing headwinds from demography, in that these are countries are aging. So you have many, many more, a higher percent of people over 65 in the retirement zone. You have very low fertility rates, so the kids aren't coming up into the labor force. So labor force is either stagnant, in a couple of places it'll start shrinking in the 2020s. But, you know, the arithmetic of real GDP is basically can be divided into labor force growth plus labor productivity growth. And so if your labor productivity is like a 1.5% a year average over decades, and I actually think that's going to be higher in the post-pandemic world. I think we've learned a lot about how to manage businesses and we're going to improve. So I'm optimistic on labor productivity. But even then, you know, if you're looking several years out, a 2% growth in labor productivity, 2.5%, and no labor force growth, that's what your economy is. It's a 2.5 to 3% economy. So that's the glide path we're headed toward, you know, in this kind of long run scenario.
So given that economic growth stronger than that would otherwise be inflationary?
Interesting question. And not necessarily. The inflation debate is really fascinating, and a lot of us have been doing plenty of research into it. And one of the things that's hard to makes this debate more complex is that we don't have a good theory of inflation. Our old theories of inflation don't work, or they may once have worked, but they don't work anymore. Like, take the money supply theory. That was pretty good in the 60s and 70s. You grew the money supply. 18 to 24 months later, you got inflation. Very strong statistical relationship. And then the world of money changed. We got, you know, in the late 70s, interest on checking accounts, and then asset management accounts, and ubiquitous use of credit cards. And in the 90s, smartphones and the internet age, where we can pay and move money around very easily, pay from all different accounts. There is no link between any money supply measure and inflation anymore. So that theory just doesn't work.
And wait, I'm sorry, Blue. I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you say that again? Because I think I've never heard that. Because I was, you know, grew up in the era, I believe it was Milton Friedman who said inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. And you're saying now there is no link between the two. So what the Fed is doing doesn't matter when it comes to inflation?
The Fed has very, very little influence over inflation in the modern world. It used to have quite a bit. Now, here's the thing, what the Fed can do. So if the Fed buys government securities, so say there's a government security dealer, they sell the Fed some 10-year treasuries. The Fed pays for that by crediting the account of the dealer with federal funds, which count as excess reserves for that depository, that institution. Now, what does the institution do with the excess reserves? There isn't any link left between excess reserves and loan creation. Banks have plenty of excess reserves, but doesn't mean they're going to make loans. They make loans based on their own view of the economy, their own capital requirements, the credit risk of their clients. But, you know, the Fed's not in that equation. So we have a situation where the Fed can buy quantitative easing, it can buy assets, it creates all these excess reserves in the banking system, but that doesn't force the banks to make loans and expand, that would expand consumption and so forth. So the Federal Reserve has the ability to support asset prices. So, you know, after the 2008 Great Recession, when the Fed came in very, very strong, the equity market turned around in March of 2009 and went up for years and years and years. And in the pandemic of 2020, the Fed came in and said, you know, we're going to buy trillions of dollars worth of securities. And the equity market turned in March of 2020 and had a great rally. So the Federal Reserve can definitely support asset prices, but its impact on inflation, it means to do have an impact on inflation, it has to increase consumption. And the way that used to work in the bank market is the Fed would do something and banks would lend more or lend less, depending on whether they were loosening or tightening. That link isn't there and hasn't been there for 25, 30 years.
Aaron, if you remember, this is an argument espoused by Mark Dow, among others, that once you understand the mechanism by which the Fed expands its balance sheet, you realize that that is not necessarily that link, as Blue talked about, is not there anymore, and that it's not right. Really inflationary, although it can't support asset prices from time to time.
Yeah, the Fed has the ability to put a floor under a problematic recession or something. So, you know, after 2008, you know, that financial panic, the Fed went in right quickly and bought $1 trillion worth of distressed securities. And that really helped the banking system recover. In the pandemic, it was a little different. The Fed bought a lot of government securities and that raised asset prices, really turned the pandemic around and kept the economy doing as well as it did, was the fiscal policy responses that were pretty quick from the Trump administration and then more from the Biden administration. So the fiscal policy really was the decider of putting a floor under the economy this time around.
Right. So we're going to take a quick break in a second, but I do want to just ask, because it's something that Stephen and I have asked other guests here, you know, the idea that bond yield, meaning prices are rising, bond yields have been falling the last several months, despite or maybe because of spikes in inflation. There is the question of what the Fed's buying, if that is warping price discovery, I will say. I use the word warping. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the Fed is not a profit maximizer. It has a different criteria for its purchases. The Fed also typically doesn't sell anything. It buys and holds to maturity. So the Fed's balance, you know, at $8 trillion, it's, you know, before the Great Recession in 2007, the Fed's balance sheet was under a trillion. So, you know, it's hard to argue that the Fed hasn't influenced bond yields in some serious way over the last decade, and particularly over the last, year when they bought $3 trillion worth of securities. So yes, I think the Fed has impacted the price discovery process. But once the Fed went on a steady state, you know, they're buying $80 billion of treasuries every month and $40 billion of mortgages, and everybody knows it. The impact of what the Fed's doing is not as large as it was when the programs got started and the Fed announced the buying program. So, you know, they still have an impact, but it's not quite as big. We do have to worry about the impact of tapering, as they pull out of the market, the private sector, both domestic and international, is going to have to pick up the buying because there's going to be plenty of treasury securities to be bought. So, yes, the price discovery process has been impacted. No doubt about it.
But it doesn't sound to you like it's the major or even a significant issue as we're talking here today.
I don't think it's the it was a big issue back in March, April, and May of last year when the Fed went on that buying spree where it ramped up its balance sheet by $3 trillion really fast. But now that they're on a much slower, steady state path, it's not as big an issue, a matter of degree here. But, you know, the bond market, the 10-year, for instance, does not provide any premium over inflation. The 10-year yield is under the prevailing rate of inflation. So it's pretty hard to argue that the bond market's all that worried about inflation.
Right. And that begs the question of, you know, what's your alternative if bond yield, real yields are negative, which we'll pick up after we take a quick break. You're listening to Alpha Trader. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. Aaron Task and Stephen Alfer. Our guest today is Blue Putnam. He's chief economist at CME Group. On a quick programming note, if you're a regular listener, you've probably noticed already we are now dropping this podcast on Wednesdays. We moved it back a day to accommodate summer schedules. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. And of course, let us know what you think about our schedules, our guests, and the host. Just be gentle on us. So, Blue, I want to pick it up where we left off. In terms of the implications for investors, you have a report coming out where you write, in a scenario of rising inflation and higher bond yields, long duration, growth-heavy market indices may underperform on a relative basis, even if equity market continue to see rising prices overall, end quote. So that was a concern, you know, for a lot of investors, I think a month or two ago, certainly. Now we're flipping the script a bit. So again, is that your base case for equity markets for the next, let's say, 6 to 18 months? Or has what's happened in the bond market here the last month or two, where now, again, there is no alternative, real rates are negative, and the 10-year is not offering any competition for stocks, at least on paper. So as an equity investor, what are the implications of that?
Well, first of all, the idea of interest rate sensitivity of equities is something we call duration in the fixed income market. And the growthier the stock, the more the growth rates are pushed out into the future, and you know, you have that compounding effect, then those are considered long duration stocks. So NASDAQ is a more long duration index than, say, the Dow Jones or the Russell 2K or something like that. So they're just more interest rate sensitive. And, you know, and we had rising bond yields from October through about March or April, October of last year, March or April of this year. And during that period, you know, NASDAQ and the Dow Jones, they both went up, but the Dow Jones did outperform NASDAQ over some of that period. And that was really a duration story. But now that bond yields have fallen, and we're not as worried about longer term inflation, it kind of takes that off the table. But longer duration stocks would to do better if you weren't worried about the economy too. And so I think we've shifted gears from worrying about bond yields rising to worrying about the economy. And that's a different kind of calculus. You know, that's more thinking about the traditional, what's earnings going to be next year and things like that. So, you know, we're out of that bond yield phase for a little bit. Now, if bond yields were to start to rise again, if that were to happen, then NASDAQ might underperform a little bit, but bond yields be rising in the context of a good economy. So all the markets would see a rebound at that point.
Right. And just quick, maybe the reaction to earnings this season is, like you were saying earlier about the state of the economy, maybe people are thinking this is as good as it gets if the economy is going to slow, what we're seeing in some of these second quarter results.
Yeah, but I'm very, very cautious of extrapolating the economic forecast into an earnings forecast. I think quite a few companies learned a lot during the pandemic about how their businesses work, and they've improved their business models. Cost control is at the fore in many industries. And so, you know, if we're going to have a recession, then I certainly worry about earnings, but that's not what's happening here. We're just talking about the Delta variant slowing down the pace of the rebound. That's a subtlety, but we're not going into a recession. And so, I think earnings can outperform the economy. That's the bottom line here.
And I wanted to return to old canards about inflation. You've discussed why you think the link between the money supply and inflation is irrevocably broken. I wanted to talk about the link between wages and inflation. Obviously, the stories are everywhere about companies having trouble finding workers, big bonuses being paid, wages being hiked. I've heard retailers literally unable, you know, having to cut back their guidance on how many new stores they're opening because they literally cannot find people to staff those stores. Are wages going to lead to the next great inflation?
You know, I don't think so, but that's definitely one of the theories that was active again back in the 70s. It was the wages go up, inflation goes up, the wage cost push ideas. I think a lot has changed in the world. You know, the share of wages in national income is used to be above 50% in the 70s, and it's down in the low 40s now. So it's still important, but it's not as critical to a company's future bottom line. Technology has dramatically improved. Even companies that you don't think about being technology companies have learned to harness technology in a way that makes them more scalable. And what do I mean by scalable? It means that they can increase their output without their costs going up as much as you might have thought in the past. Certainly true in the financial sector that, you know, if you have a period of elevated trading in stocks, bonds, futures, and options, and so forth. The technology handles that. You don't increase your staffing just because that goes on. So we have a lot of, with online businesses and shopping, if you do have greater volumes, then you got to deliver the goods. So you may need some drivers to deliver things. You may need some warehouse workers, and that's where some of the shortages are occurring, as well as in restaurants. But these are largely lower paying jobs, and the jobs are there, the openings are there because the business is there. So as the jobs get filled, I don't think there's a longer term inflation pressure there because we're in a pretty competitive environment. That's the other thing that's changed from 3 or 4 decades ago. Comparison shopping is a piece of cake right now. The cost of information has gone down. So we can find out things, we can compare goods, we can compare prices, and that heightens the competition. So companies don't want to lose market share, so they're going to be a lot more reluctant to raise prices long-term. They might have to do it short-term depending on the shortage nature, and that's obviously happening. But longer-term, it's not clear to me. So last point on this is, if you remember your economics 101, you were taught that marginal cost rises with output. So if you want to expand your output, your costs are going to go up on the margin. And that's just not true for many, many sectors of the economy anymore. It's true for some, but it's not true across the board anymore. You know, a lot of major companies can expand their output with a minimal expansion of expenses. And so that's what we call scalability. And that's what we seek. When you're looking at these high growth companies in NASDAQ, most of them have excellent scalability.
So Blue, I wanted to ask about one other sort of historical correlation or something that a lot of us grew up with, which is that surging commodity prices occur in an inflation cycle. I mean, we've had a big lift in a lot of commodities, certainly since the reopening, and some of the air has come out of that, certainly. And when you see it, look at lumber, for example, but there's been a lot of talk about another commodity super cycle. Do you think that is in the offing here?
Well, let's define super cycle. Pretty super cycle. So commodities, that means it's broad-based across a lot of commodities. We're not just talking about one thing. Super. It better be like 3 times prices going up 300 or 400% over and of course cycle, we want a long period of time. So we have to have it has to be broad-based, it has to be really impressive, and it has to last a long time. So if you look back in history, 5-6 decades, there are two big ones, the 70s. I attribute the 70s commodity cycle to the decline of the U.S. dollar. The dollar declined pretty much year after year after year for a decade. And that was when, we went off fixed exchange rates, the dollar standard in 1971, and the dollar didn't really stabilize till around 1980, one. And so commodities are typically priced in dollars, and they were just part of that inflation equation. People started talking at that time about a vicious circle or cycle where the exchange rate would go down and then prices and commodity prices would rise and then the exchange dollar would go further down. So I don't see that happening again. The European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, all these major central banks are pretty much on the same page. And if they're on the same page, you know, we can get exchange rate movements among the major currencies, but nothing like a 10-year dollar decline. So I'm going to rule that source of the commodity cycle out. In the 2000s, the early 2000s, the driver was China. China was growing 10% plus every year, and they were a huge buyer of commodities. Now, they drove that commodity cycle, but we didn't see a lot of inflation at the consumer price level then. So, you know, commodities can go up and you don't necessarily have a general inflation. But China was the driver. And if you look at China in the 2020s, their population's going to peak in the next couple of years and then decline. Their labor force will be declining in the latter half of the decade. They're just in, and of course, they're much more industrialized than they were 20, 30 years ago. They've made a lot of progress, and they're pretty much a modern country, in my view. So, you know, their growth rates are going to slow down. They're going to grow, and they're probably going to outgrow the U.S. and Europe. But, you know, the 10% days are gone, and probably so are the 6 or 7% days once we get out of the pandemic rebound. So, China's not a driver for me of the commodities. What I do see happening, and it happened right after the Great Recession. In 2008, you know, commodity prices got hit pretty hard. They bounced back. They had a nice bounce back as we recovered from the Great Recession. And I see that happening. We're having a pandemic bounce back. Whether it turns into a super cycle, that's for you guys to answer down the road.
And I'm glad you brought the dollar up. And as Aaron knows, I love having the Chicago guys on because they always talk about the dollar. Something kind of maybe others kind of neglect now and again. The dollar has had a nice move higher. Once again, it's bounced off the 90 level. And as I look back on a really long-term chart for all the wiggles and talk about the Fed, the dollar is basically versus a basket of currencies, basically at the same level it was more than 20 years ago. So I don't know if that says anything about the dollar or says something more about, you know, what the euro and the yen have done. But in any case, the dollar has not collapsed. It's been, you know, I could look at it and say, well, it's been stable for 21 or 22 years. And it would need to be in a kind of a long-term downtrend before I would have to start worrying about inflation again.
Yeah, I think you're on the right path here is that the leading indicator to me for inflation in any country is a pretty dramatic decline of the exchange rate. So, 4 or 5% doesn't qualify as dramatic in my view. It's got to be much bigger moves. And so, you know, the dollar, when I look at it, as I mentioned earlier, the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, and even China, you know, they're basically committed to more or less the same kind of policies of keeping their keeping these exchange rates in a range. It can move. But, a decade-long decline of the dollar just doesn't seem to be there. Now, other minor country, not minor, but emerging market currencies are all different. Everyone's in a different place. You have commodity importing countries. They're totally different than commodity exporting countries. You have countries that have done a good job on the virus, countries that haven't done a good job. You've got countries that are willing to take a lot more chances with inflation. So, to me, the opportunity in the currencies is in the emerging markets, but there's no generic about it. You've got to analyze each country, each pair separately.
All right, Blue, appreciate your time here this morning. And I know you've got a hard out in just a couple minutes. So I'd like to do a very quick lightning round on a couple of things just to sum up. First of all, do you believe as the Fed states that this inflation uptick is going to be transitory?
You know, I am in my analysis is in the transitory camp, but that's, subject to change. I'll tell you, and you have to remember this, the Federal Reserve Board and the voting FOMC members that are there today may be very different next year. Biden will have an impact on the makeup of the Federal Reserve Board. So the Fed that's giving you today's guidance may not be tomorrow's Fed that's actually going to do the work. I do think there's pressure in Washington over the longer term to get rid of emergency measures and to declare some victory. Can't do that today, and maybe not even the first 6 months of next year. But down the road, when we're out of this pandemic, there's going to be pressure on the Fed to exit quantitative easing and get off zero rates, just to say we don't need emergency help anymore.
Right. And you just reminded me, we haven't even talked about the potential for more fiscal spending and the impact that could have on the economy. We'll have to say that for next time. And last question, at least for me, if I'm to summarize what I've heard from you this morning, is that it doesn't seem like you're too concerned about inflation. It doesn't seem like you're too concerned that falling bond yields are telling us the economy is going to go into a ditch. And so maybe it doesn't make a great headline or it's not overly dramatic, but that investors, you know, steady as she goes. Is that a fair summary of your message here?
Well, I think the message for the next 6 months is watch this Delta variant and what it does to the economy. And hopefully it won't slow us down as much as the market that was thinking yesterday and so forth. But that's, you know, that's good. We're really looking at the Delta variant more than we are at policy. I'm looking at inflation. It's definitely rising. It's up there, but I do believe over the next couple of months, we'll see slightly lower prints. You know, used cars were a huge influence on the last print of consumer prices. That's a temporary thing. So I am in the temporary camp, but I don't really have a view on where it's going to end up, 2%, 3% or something. You know, I don't have a view there yet. We just have to wait and see how next year goes.
All right. It is a moving target. And Blue, I know you got to move. Thanks so much for being with us. Our guest has been Blue Putnam, Chief Economist at CME Group. You've been listening to Alpha Trader.
Thanks, Blue.
Thank you.